It presently takes out marijuana possession charges as a felony conviction for this purpose. I have no objection to looking at possibly DWS felony or some other statutes that perhaps would not have any relevance to this kind of dangerous crime. That's the reason for it, the reason why we support it. Be happy to answer any questions.
The only questions, I'm sure people just don't carry those inside when they go hunting or something like that. Is there a secondary weapon or when they go out to pick up the newspaper here in your town? We've had testimony that people do that, so I'm just wondering if they have to carry their, it's 357 Magnum, I guess. They get around the concealed weapon law by just sort of carrying it. Can't do that in my county. But then we're hopefully more civilized. Can't get you to respond to this. Come on. No, I'm sorry. These things here are all illegal weapons or legal weapons?
This is legal for an ex-convict to possess in the state of Oregon at the present time because the barrel is longer than 12 inches. It technically is a violation of federal law. However, the practical ability to prosecute somebody for this offense is nil. And under the new interpretation of the federal laws, it would not be illegal under federal law. There are many others that I've seen that are much smaller than this, but they're always 12 and a quarter inches at least in length.
Dale, you mentioned the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms having changed their interpretation of federal law.
Yes.
So that unless state law prohibited the weapon, then only then could federal law prohibit it.
Yeah. The federal statute is much more specific and much broader than our local state laws about firearms. However, what the interpretation is and the way it's going to be utilized in the future is that if state law does not make the weapon illegal, federal law will not be utilized to make it illegal. Okay? So the federal statutes in their terminology would outlaw this gun. However, under present Oregon law, it's not illegal, and therefore...
Therefore, ATF will not enforce federal law within Oregon. Does that apply to machine guns also?
They believe they are trying to take a very controlled response to that interpretation from Washington, and they're trying to hold back a little bit on what actually happens in Oregon, but potentially that would apply to any weapon.
Is this a result of change in statutory law or interpretation?
No, there was amendments in the Congress that took effect in November of last year, and this is just beginning to take effect as far as interpretation and how that will actually be utilized in the states.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Did you want to say something?
Yes, Detective Nelson, Salem Police Department, from the Selective Investigations Unit there for the past 2 years. And one of the main reasons that I found the federal prosecutors will not prosecute on these is because here you only see two, but I can tell you that it's not uncommon to find these weapons and many other variations, such as this assault rifle here, out in the community on a weekly basis. In fact, this one was just found laying out there. A lot of them are in our search warrants, under cars, or just taken from people. So the sheer number of these things out there in the hands of not only ex-convicts but other violators makes it extremely impractical for the federal people to prosecute it.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jacobson.
Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. Actually, I have no problems with outlawing weapons in much greater sweep.
Pointing it at you, I guess.
Right. Much greater sweep than even this bill proposes to do. Unfortunately, we don't seem to be able to do that as a society. First of all, there's constitutional rights to bear arms implicated, and there's also a great desire among citizens of this state and other states to do legitimate activities with guns, such as hunting. So we have bills, laws like this that prohibit a certain number of certain class of people from possessing them. The problems I have with this bill is that it broadens the prohibition on possessing a whole lot of different kinds of weapons than have ever been attempted to be prohibited before among a larger class of people than traditionally have been aimed at. Originally, ex-con statutes were thought to be a good policy choice because convicts were generally viewed as hardened criminals. If a person had been convicted of a felony, historically felonies were much more serious, only consisting of the classic felonies of robbery, serious assaults, the common law felonies. We've now got a situation in Oregon where there's a whole lot of things that are felonies that don't indicate to an average person that the felon is a dangerous human being. And so I do think we have to make some distinctions if we're going to go any further with this ex-convict statute. And so, as Mr. Penn was saying, a rational way of going about that might be to simply only outlaw the general possession of weapons only among a certain class of felons, perhaps picking felons who have committed a felony with a weapon or other dangerous felonies, or Class A felonies or Class B felonies. But when we get into felony driving while suspended, theft one, and various other things, doesn't seem to be any rational reason to me to do this. Another way of attacking the same problem, and I don't think anybody is going to argue that people should have these sawed-off shotguns, would be to simply read that kind of prohibition into the statute rather than amending the statute to apply to all firearms. Leave the statute as it is, but add you have firearms capable of being concealed, machine guns, sawed-off shotguns. Why not simply add it in that way, if the sawed-off shotgun is really what we're after, and if we're not after the legitimate hunting activities of a person who happens to be a felon. Another potential problem with the bill is the hunting license or the ability to get a petition in the sentencing court to obtain a certificate to get a license. I have a little trouble with how the court would be responding in those situations. And if we want to leave something like that to the sole discretion of the sentencing court, if we want to give the court some direction about when these things should be given or not given. I mean, if it's the intent of the legislature, if you decide to do this, that a person should be able to have a legitimate hunting weapon, then we should say that in the legislation and say that if... I'm not sure of the language, and I'd be happy to attempt to work on that with Mr. Penn and the committee if the committee's interested. But attempt to say that any legitimate hunting weapon shall be allowed. I guess those are my major points. I'd be happy to answer questions.
I guess I would appreciate you working with Mr. Penn here on that. I can understand that the court may need some kind of guidelines in the legislature as to, you know, how it issues those certificates rather than, you know, leaving it kind of open, I think, particularly there. I don't know. I guess my comment on the question of felonious crimes is, rather than trying to solve that one here, I agree with you, we have too many felonies. But if the state has determined that a particular crime carries that conviction, then I guess I don't have any problem saying that kind of person ought to be restricted, whether they're dangerous or not. I think that level of crime, I think the right, to me, I'd rather approach the question of let's recodify a whole lot of things that we have in the codes. But I think your point's well made. If there is some kind of, if you do have a chance to talk to Mr. Penn about that, about trying to find some language that would be more specific, maybe relating to certain levels or something, we can take a try at that one too.
I would have suspected also that there'd be other constituencies in here.
They may
arguing.
Have missed this one.
They may have missed this one.
We're not going to let the other shoe drop without. Right. Are there questions for the questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishes to be heard on House Bill 2965? Okay, we'll move Okay, I would like, we have a call to the caucus, but I want to let, there's some people I know that have been waiting on some of these, and I'm gonna stick in here for a few minutes. If the rest of the members have to go, do that. I will follow shortly. I'd like to try to get to 3061, 3063, at least, if we could. So let's do 3061. Folks have been sitting in. Al Freoff, are you all together? Good.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Dan Lambert. I'm a lieutenant with Portland Police. I work in North Precinct in the uniform section. We encourage your support of this bill dealing with the attempting to elude a police officer bill that was presented by Representative Menace. Our concern is the fact that the existing law applies straight across the board to a person. For example, on the lesser extreme would be a kid could be on a moped, a dirt bike, a motorcycle, something of that nature, screwing around. We get onto him, there's a chase, we catch him, he could be cited for the traffic crime of attempting to elude. On the other hand, I brought a 16-minute tape that we probably won't have time to listen to any of it. It's the classical fleeing felon, wanted armed robber, in a car. This is the second time he's been chased in a one-week period. The first time he successfully got away, he was chased from Washington into Oregon over to St. John's. Several cars damaged, police cars damaged, some people injured. We finally got this guy. We propose that the existing law be modified to allow the officer's discretion of writing a misdemeanor traffic citation for the attempting to elude, and in the cases as flagrant as this one that I just cited, that the person be arrested under a felony eluding charge. I might mention that this would make the law compatible with the state of Washington, in which case they have determined that traffic violation or crime was so serious that they upgraded it to a felony. Yeah, I believe that we should do the same.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to go ahead and testify?
Yes, sir. My name is Al Freoff. I'm patrolman for the City of Portland Bureau of Police. I've been assigned to traffic for 15 years. I rode bikes for 9 years. I became aware of this particular problem. There were some chases initiated during the daytime in which the vehicles crossed either the I-5 bridge into Washington, and most recently there have been a couple others across the I-205 bridge into Washington. The problem being that once you hit the state line, you have to terminate your chase, and WSP North Vancouver Police Department can always be at the other end to pick up the chase and find out why this person is running. And the problem is that it's a misdemeanor. And if Washington catches them, there's no way Oregon can bring them back. There's no extradition for misdemeanors, and the officer who initiates the chase cannot continue the chase into another state unless it is a felony. So he has to terminate the chase, the state line, and shut down. And the person I can think of within the past 3 months, four occasions, motor officers have had to terminate chases into Washington. The person was never seen again. And if it were elevated, I realize it's another statute asking for an amendment to a felony, but amending it to a felony would allow us to stop the people from doing it and hopefully. That was it. Do you have any questions?
Boy, did you want to make a comment?
No, that's okay.
The next question I'd have on this is the do you suppose that when somebody makes a is fleeing in the case of this individual you're talking about, take the one where somebody comes from Washington over there in a reckless situation, things like that. Is the Class A misdemeanor, that is usually one of several charges probably that's brought against that individual, I would assume.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Well, let's say it is the only charge. Would you find that individual might be surprised that it's only a misdemeanor when they get that particular citation?
When he comes from Washington into Oregon and we...
Or even, let's say it's within the state, let's just say it's a reckless charge, the person is recklessly trying to elude you, and you... I'm trying to picture in my mind a situation, and I hear about these, read about them, and you're in my precinct out there in North, and so I try to drive safely. But there's what kind of circumstances would be where somebody, most of the ones you hear about are usually involve several police pursuit situations, there are wrecked cars, there are a number of other charges I think that would be brought against somebody other than just this one charge. What kind of situation would occur where this would be the only charge?
I have the three that I spoke of were on the freeway. The motor officer was attempting to stop somebody behind them, pulled up very close to the siren on. Person looked at them, just kept right on going. Already on a freeway, attempting to stop them for going an excessive rate of speed to begin with, they continue on across the bridge, and that's a termination of the chase.
Okay.
If you remained in state and you had the good old traditional straight shot freeway chase where the guy happens to have a faster car than the police car, which is very common, and just flat blows by you and we lose him, I wouldn't consider that a felony, a lewd. We're concerned with the chases that go through the neighborhoods, the business areas, blowing red lights at 80, 90, 100 miles an hour. These are the things that from which people get killed. And traditionally, when we catch these folks, we generally have them either they're wanted on a felony or they've come from a family beef where they've assaulted or shot somebody. At least in North Portland, they usually do. They're either DUI. DW driving while suspended, habitual offenders, no insurance, they have a high accident rate already, a high conviction rate, and they're frequently ex-convicts. We're not trying to load them up with another felony just for, you know, because we think that's going to change their behavior, but the word has got to get out to some of the people, especially the younger people, that we got to get tough on this eluding law. Because the younger folks don't seem to be getting the word.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman? Officers, what policy does the Portland Police Department have in regards to chases?
I could say that we are only allowed to have one primary car in the chase. He'll have the visual on the car, one secondary car. Generally, a supervisor can follow in if he likes. It's up to that supervisor, a sergeant or a lieutenant, to make darn sure that it doesn't become a wolf pack chasing this person wherever he may go. There may be parallel chase cars on alternate streets. There may be other cars designated to block intersections so that when the guy does go flying through, hopefully they can stop enough civilian traffic that somebody won't get clobbered at a high speed. At any point, the officer has the discretion of just saying, I quit, or the sergeant can order everybody to abort the pursuit. This does happen, and it happens fairly frequently. It's not a macho thing where the officers get hung up on having to catch the guy. We frequently just have to back off because it's just not worth the risk.
Along that same line, my present assignment is in hit and run, and we do fatal investigations within the past year. I've been involved in three fatal investigations wherein there was a police pursuit. And in all three instances, the people were driving in such a manner that the officers had, if not in one instance, the officer was, it was 12 blocks behind the vehicle when it blew the red light and took out, killed an innocent person. The officer was, in essence, terminating the pursuit. The other one, the officer had already terminated the pursuit, and the person continued another 2 miles before he managed to do himself in. And the last one, the officer was one car that was in pursuit was 5 blocks behind it, and he wasn't going, he was going as fast as he felt was safe, and the car was leaving him. There is the policy and the feeling and the training to not push them any faster than we feel we can drive safely.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Where do you live, Dan?
In Gresham.
Is there a law against that? Okay. Becky Hampton?
Mr. Chairperson, I'm Becky Hampton, Manager of Program Support Section at the Motor Vehicles Division. Our testimony today on House Bill 3061 is the same basic testimony that Tony DiLorenzo presented to your subcommittee about 2 weeks ago on House Bill 2616. Our concern is narrowed to a conflict in the suspension or revocation procedures under Chapter 809 for us. By making eluding a felony under certain circumstances, it creates a conflict with suspension or revocation authority. Under the current law, when a person is convicted of eluding, either the court or Motor Vehicles Division suspends the driving privileges under 809.410 sub 8. The subsection there is specific to convictions for eluding. However, 809.410 sub 4 requires revocation in circumstances where there is a felony and a motor vehicle was used in the commission of that felony. Our legal counsel advises us that that conflict could cause either action we might take to be rendered invalid. And what we would recommend to resolve that conflict is an amendment to 809.410 sub 4, suggesting that it would only apply in circumstances where no other statute specifically applied.
Okay, so. Okay, there are some amendments that have been drafted by Legislative Council, I believe.
On 2616?
I think so on this one, so we'll have to take a look at that. You have them there? Is that on 3061 or on?
This was on 26. Representative Minnis gave me these, knowing that our bill was in concept the same as his bill.
Okay. Well, let me just ask this then. Could you make a copy of that available to Becky, and then take a look at that, because we're going to have to find some way to bring these two bills together or go one way, route or the other one. So if you do that, I'd appreciate that, and you get back as we get to work session on this. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real conflict here because they're after me. And we're going to have to take an adjournment. It's 3063. I know, is it Ken Chichester?
Yes.
You're here on that one, and there is on 2859 Timothy Wood. Is there anybody here else on any other bills? Good to have you waiting. I'm going to have to adjourn the committee for a period of time and come back. I don't want you guys to have to stick around. So what I'm going to do is on 3063, could you come up, Ken, and we'll go ahead and hold the hearing. Steve, you have lots of shots at it, so let these guys. You want to be heard on 3063? Would you mind coming up? Are you guys in agreement on this, or are you going to disagree?
A little bit.
You're both armed. I don't want to.
Okay.
Yeah. If you wouldn't mind kind of moving rapidly through it. Thank you. Lieutenant, why don't you proceed with.
For the record, my name is Ken Chichester. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police assigned to our patrol division and general headquarters in Salem. The purpose in testifying today is to relate some concerns regarding House Bill 3063 regarding proposed changes to statutes for the hit-and-run statute. In the bill, Section 1C, line 16 of the bill, requires the driver of a hit-and-run vehicle to give the other driver and any passenger their name, address, registration of the vehicle, and name and address of any other occupants of the vehicle. It's our feeling that this change will make the meaning of the statute ambiguous and confusing. It could be read two different ways. It may require a person involved in a motor, in a minor accident with, say, a city bus, to provide information to the driver and every passenger on the bus. It also could mean that information is provided to the driver and any one of the passengers. We would recommend that the wording be changed back to the existing statute, which says driver or passenger. Section 2, sub 1, sub C, line 16 of the bill, we would recommend the wording be reverted again back to the original statute. Section 2, subsection 2, lines 27 to 30, the proposed change would make the offense a misdemeanor unless the person failed to stop and, if necessary, render assistance to any injured person. We believe the terminology, if necessary, is ambiguous. The offense would be difficult to enforce and to prosecute in court. Hit and run is a serious crime. We believe the fact that it is presently a felony has a deterrent effect on the driver involved in an accident. As an enforcement tool, we would recommend the offense remain a Class C felony. And lastly, in Section 3B, line 36, and near the end of the bill, we recommend the wording again be reverted to its original form that's in the current statute at this time. It's the end of my testimony. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Basically, then, you're in favor of just leaving the statutes as they are, particularly in relationship to the... If I understand the bill, it actually reduces the level of penalty.
It would reduce, in some cases, a injury hit and run to a misdemeanor rather than a felony. Yes.
Thank you very much. Do you want to...
Yes, Representative. I gave you a brief outline there. I'm sorry for the briefness of the outline. I was asked to come down here yesterday morning and didn't get a whole lot of chance to present a whole lot of things. I did do some little homework and obtained some statistics. There were over 2,700 hit and runs in the city of Portland last year, of which 377 would be classified as a felony hit and run under the statute as it presently is. 109 of those were cleared by arrest. 34 of them were what we call exceptionally cleared. That means we know who did it, but for some reason we're not prosecuting. 46 are still pending. 171 of them were suspended. Now, they could be suspended for several reasons. There's liability accepted. Somebody accepted financial liability for the accident. There's several different reasons. 17 of them were found to be unfounded. The problem that we have is the leaving it as a felony. There's no reduction. It's either a felony or it's nothing at all. This is the dealing with the first group there, the pedestrian accidents, working in hit and run. I see the reports come in of the minor injuries that don't become apparent until later. The person goes home, finds out he's got a concussion. He doesn't have the necessary information. The only thing I can go after the driver for is for a felony. He may have stopped and rendered aid, but it's still a felony because he didn't provide his name. The pedestrians that don't request the information due to their injuries. We had a particular case in Portland where there was and have been people injured at the scene, transported to the hospital by the driver. At the hospital, the driver refuses to give any information. At that point, the only recourse I have to go after the driver is for a felony. That's the only thing the district attorney can prosecute him on, is a felony. The last one, the person involved in an accident was the first time it was unique, but it's happened since. We had a car that struck a cement pillar. A piece of the vehicle flew off onto the oncoming lanes of the freeway through an open window and struck another driver in the face, cutting him. I had to go after the driver of that car for a felony because he was involved in the accident. He was struck secondarily by a piece of the other vehicle. The only thing that we could charge him was for a felony. We suspended the case with liability accepted because obviously it's not reasonable to go after the other driver for a felony. If the statute were amended, it would speed prosecution in that it would allow for reduction of charges in those obvious cases where it was called for from a felony to a misdemeanor. The attorneys now, if it's a minor case where the piece goes across on the other side of the freeway, request a trial because at a trial they know at the best, you know, the worst he can get is a guilty finding with no sentencing or no fine. So there's more trials simply because the way the statute is set up allow for lower and more equitable sentencing and not burden the jail system with something that doesn't really need to be burdened with. And at the bottom, reduce the court costs that we're finding. And one of the things is the grand juries. If it's a felony, you have to take it before a grand jury. And that's about it.
What would be your response to the bus?
I have talked to the lieutenant, and on those two, I agree. I had one involving a bus, and I could see on line 16 on both sides, that would be